It is Saturday, October 26th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KOSP.org. It's time for Geek Speak. Hey, welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. You know, Ben, I think this morning I need to slow down a little bit.
Are you a little tired?
You know, I'm removing parts of syllables of words. When I go fast enough, that's what I do.
If Miles ridiculous. Were here, he would say, good said.
Yes, that's true.
A lot. He would say that a lot.
This is Ben Jaffe, who you hear in the air room with me. He's a technology teacher, a musician, a web developer, and an organic farmer enthusiast.
Am I?
Sure.
I'm a farming enthusiast.
Today you are.
Oh. Organic farming is hard.
Yes.
Because everything has to be organic.
Farming's hard, too.
It is. Well, in a way, it's kind of amazing how with farming, with growing fungus and mushrooms, with making beer, with making cheese, yogurt, all these things, you just have to set up the initial conditions right, maybe monitor a little bit, but pretty much it just takes care of itself.
Yeah.
So yeah. It was hard to get my garden going because we had to rototill.
We had clay soil,
rocks and bricks, yeah. And just it was ridiculous.
That's the thing that's always funny about like that kind of project. You're like, I want to grow my own food. I want to be partially self-sustainable. I want to you set up the conditions as you said, and then it just kind of happens. Especially in California, we have such amazing weather climate, and so it grows and everything. But of course, that first initial state, it's all this work, and you went and used a rototiller, right? So a petrol powered machine built probably on the other side of the planet that got shipped overseas, all these parts.
Yeah.
And then it's great.
Yeah, it's great.
You can do that with picks and axes and stuff.
If you just go into the forest and plant things in the forest, the problem
then
is
you're
that
feeding
I
the
live
deer
in
is the problem.
I guess that's true. That's true.
Today on Geek Farming, I guess, what we're talking
about. what are we talking about today?
How are your fruit trees doing?
My fruit trees are doing wonderfully.
Do you like that one that has like the shared pot thing with multiple?
We bought 2 3-in-1 trees. We bought 2 3-in-1 trees. And
wait, who's we? What do you mean?
We is me and Masumi, my partner.
You know, should. Oh my gosh, she's here. Hi.
On
no, well, we started talking about farming. You never know what's going to happen on Geek Speak.
It's amazing.
I mean, not that having a backyard garden is farming. I mean, it's not the business of farming, but growing your own food.
I love, in particular, Masumi, your obsession with mycorrhiza and mushrooms and funguses. And so, like driving over, we were just talking about fungus.
Okay, wait a second. Ben, you stop. Masumi, go ahead.
Okay, I can try my best. I just read this book called Mycelium Running by Paul Stamets, and it's gotten me obsessed with mushrooms and fungi and mycorrhiza. And basically, it's just talking about soil fertility. I mean, people are basically buying things from nurseries in these sterile pots and then having to fertilize them all the time, when in nature, we have this fungus system underneath the ground that's basically connecting trees to each other and being able to tap into so much more nutrients that people don't really need to fertilize. Like, you don't go into forests and sprinkle fertilizer all over the place.
So you're kind of talking like a climate inside the soil that balances itself, that builds. The kind of thing that you start to learn about when you like have a small fish tank and you realize that as the fish go to the bathroom, then you get nitrates, and the nitrates, of course, cause plant growth, and the plant growth, actually the fish can then eat the plants. So you get this kind of, you start kind of being aware when you have a microclimate like that. I hadn't thought about it in the idea that the soil you get from in those pots has to be completely sterile, because, of course, they don't want anything extra growing in it, right? So they kind of kill the dirt.
Right. It's just a whole different thing. Modern American suburban gardening is a completely different animal in some ways than what you would find in nature. So suddenly people are, in some ways, I think, making their lives more rigid and more fear-based. And they're doing all these things that would have happened naturally in nature and making the whole thing more difficult. A good example is adding phosphorus to soil. Like, what I've been reading is that too much phosphorus in soil makes it harder for plants to absorb, to connect with the mycorrhiza, this fungal network. And so then the plants might create more roots in order to make up for this lack of relationship. But what happens is if you didn't add extra phosphorus to the soil, the plants would start producing acids through their roots, which would connect them to the mycorrhiza that would start the relationship. The mycorrhiza would then actually break down the phosphorus and introduce it to the plant in a way that it could more easily accept the phosphorus.
Oh my gosh, that's fascinating.
So people are adding all these phosphorus-laden nutrients to their gardens.
What's the purpose of adding that? Why are we told that we should do that?
Well, phosphorus is known, from what I've read, is to help roots and also for helping like flowers bud and things. I'm a real novice at this.
Yeah. Well, I love the idea that we go, oh, well, large roots for plants really important. So let's add phosphorus to the soil so that the plant, or add phosphorus to the plant so the plant will have larger roots. But the truth is the reason it has to do that is it's not as efficient at doing something it can't. I mean, so it has to build new roots. So it has more roots to pull in the nutrients it needs. But if you actually didn't give it, it'd be actually more efficient at pulling the nutrients. That's kind of what you're saying, right?
Right, yeah. Wow, we're basically creating cycles of dependency, which is very common for humans.
It sure just seems to be that way. It's like that class example, let's kill this predator because it's really bad. Oh, and then it not having that predator means that this species all of a sudden show up. Now, eventually we have all these rabbits that are eating everything, right? So then you got to kill the rabbits.
Yeah.
Right? Instead of just leave the foxes there and you know, protect your chickens and you'll be okay. It'll actually be good. Like that event that we seem to do really commonly is try to make a big change and then have to deal with all the consequences of it.
Yeah. Right, exactly. I mean, it's just like people are being too heavy-handed. That's what I'm just reading over and over and over again, is humans are too heavy-handed.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, I didn't expect us to be talking about farming at that level especially, or soil nutrition level. Thank you for stepping in so quickly. We didn't get to introduce you. Ben, you want to give Masima's title or something? We normally do that.
Well, how would you call yourself?
Okay.
But you work at a nursery, so you're a gardener.
I would say a novice gardening enthusiast.
Ooh, novice and enthusiast. So you get you're really safe there.
She claims no responsibility
for knowledge.
You're a geek.
Yeah, you're a geek.
You're a true gardening and many other things geek.
I do know that anytime I have spare time, I usually have my nose in a book or a forum having to do with gardening.
I look forward to more updates from you about what you've been reading. That's awesome. Let's jump into a story of the day since we're on Geek Speak and we have some of them.
What's the story of the day?
I don't know. I think... I'm totally frazzled because the last 2 weeks I've been crazily moving around. Thanks for doing the show last week.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
Bonnie and you covered it. We had glowing reviews of Bonnie, which of course to me is like, yeah, I know she's awesome. Of course she's good.
Oh, poor Lyle.
And she speaks clearly.
I think you're great too.
Oh, thanks so much.
Yeah.
So, thank you so much for doing that. I was actually off in Vegas with my son, which was kind of a kick to take a 12-year-old to Las Vegas.
Whoa,
it's kind of the wrong place to have a 12-year-old.
How was that?
It was wonderful. I mean, you know, I spent the weekend with my son. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, it's a spectacle place, and it's disgusting in every way. It represents... It was great.
If any of our listeners live in Vegas, feel free to write us
I think everyone understands that you walk out of the hotel and you're on the strip, and it's like, oh, so if you had more money and you knew what to do with, and you just needed more people so you could take more of their money, that's what you'd build. Like, that's the answer to why is that there? Yeah. Oh, right, because it would pull more people in for... It's really not... It's sad that that's, like, a success for us as a species.
Yeah,
that's the thing.
The only defense I want to offer for Las Vegas, the string, Las Vegas, is that... Vegas is not all bad. It's the strip that's bad. It's the place
Did
that people go.
Did you say the string for Las Vegas?
No, the strip.
The string.
Yeah, the string,
so
Las Vegas.
Let's explain that for a second.
Wait,
as a programmer, because
pause that thought for just a second. I just want to say that the Vegas Strip, where all the hotels are, all the casinos are, all of the money is extracted from the pockets of people who probably wouldn't give it voluntarily, and all the faux opulence as well. That's just part of the town, of the city. Of course, there's a massive network of people who run this operation, who are good, wonderful people and live in wonderful communities. But of course, the images that Vegas conjures up are not that. The
right.
images that Vegas conjures up.
And there are some
are.
Benefits, too. Okay, one thing I thought was kind of amazing. The hotel I was in was in the Cosmopolitan Hotel. It's
yep.
got two towers. That hotel, I started chatting with staff, as I do. You know, I'm showing Glass to everybody, so I interact with
yeah,
a lot of people.
Yeah, Google Glass.
Google Glass, yeah. And so I'm sharing that with people, and I'm talking with them. Like, what do you do? You know, and how many people work in the hotel? You know, 5,000 people. 5,000
people
worth of.
And
I was like,
what?
What? I could, like, that's amazing.
Two orders
I was like,
of
wait,
magnitude.
How many people
from,
can you store
maybe
here?
One.
Like, well, we have just under 3,000 rooms, I think they said. But the amount of people they can fit, the bed density, whatever, is crazy. But they can hold, in the hotel, they can hold 60,000 people at the events and venues of that one building.
What?
Right. What? It was insane.
60,
well, they got large venue for like show space and outdoor pool space and like that. Was he said if you did all of it, you could do that. It was just mind-blowing.
That
mind-blowing
is
experience.
Ridiculous.
But that was one hotel, and there's lots of them.
There are
yeah.
a lot of them.
And then everybody I chatted with, you know, they don't live near downtown. They drive out, and all the cab drivers way far away from the place. And of course, like, yeah, I drive here when I work. And so the people that live there, it's not. I think saying it's disgusting, I think everybody would agree with it. But of course, I don't mean it. The other thing is, Wyatt and I went to Love.
You saw Love. Yes, that's a Cirque du Soleil show.
Yeah, it's all based around the Beatles, and it's just Beatles music. And, you know, you and I as theater people with all the history.
Yeah, I saw
of, like,
that
knowing,
too.
Yeah, oh, good. Yeah. I knew you'd seen it. Seeing the show, you know, with him, we got in as soon as the doors opened. And of course, the usher came up to me afterwards and said, right when I sat down, in the hallway, you were using Google Glass. You don't have it on now. Are you going to keep them off during the show? I was like, yeah, I'm going to keep them off. That's why I put them away. Because they were like, they knew the guy in the room would have been spoken to by somebody else, some manager that had been watching the crowd. Because they knew. So he went and found me. Even though I didn't have glass on in this theater at all, I took it off before I went. I thought it was really interesting. So they're very aware of what's going on. They're sending notes to each other. But sitting there with Wyatt and talking about, you know, where the lighting's coming from, all the pre-show stuff, how the projectors are going, relatively quickly, you and I, of course, look up projectors. I'm like, oh, where's that being thrown from? And I saw, I was like, that's not projectors. All the cloud stuff in this opening scene, they're not using projectors. They're using gobos.
Gobos are pieces of cut metal that you can put in front
these
of lights.
These are glass gobos.
Yeah. So typically they're cut metal. They can also be glass. And basically what they do is they obscure part of a light and then they let another part of a light through so you can create effects. Like a simple effect would be just a shape on the wall, and a more complicated effect with the glass gobo would be like a cloud. A cloud, yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which was nice because of that, they had the cloud. They were very bright. They didn't have to do a one location projection point. Mm-hmm. And all the instruments were moving instruments. So they had the gobos moving and rotating and stuff. It looked like really good sky. And I've done projection sky that size. You would have had a 1080p projector, pretty expensive, but also the computer run it, you know. So it was cool to see the efficiency of using the system they had. I like that.
I don't actually know. I'm going off of memory. I saw it maybe 2 years ago or something. But it seemed to me that they had HD projectors.
Oh, they did that too.
On either side, doubled up. So we had double length.
That long strip, I don't know if you remember this, above two parts of the audience, two segments.
We have seen the round.
Cirque du Soleil in this concert, the Love show, which is at, oh, now I can't remember which hotel which casino we were in.
One of the hotels they're doing a show. They built the theater for the show.
No, they modified the theater. It was a proscenium theater first,
then
modified it into a. So a theater in the round, you have the stage in the center of the room, and you have audience all around that space. And it's very much a circus kind of feeling. That does have that feeling.
Yeah.
And a proscenium stage, you actually have the audience on one side, and then there's a wall that represents this in the stage, and there's
and
a separating wall,
and
the curtain.
That's
like a traditional theater, like a movie theater you'd go to see a movie. Those are all proscenium type style. And then there's thrust, like partial thrust stages, like Shakespeare Santa Cruz. UCSC's main stage theater is
where the stage will actually come out into the audience
a little bit. It's partially around kind of feel.
Yeah, exactly. If you're out there.
Yeah. So funny. When I don't prep for Geek Speak and we're a little short on stories, this is what we talk about. We talk about where I travel and theater, because that's where I know where I live.
I've got stories. But
The Cirque du Soleil show's point is that it's in the center and there are projectors. Those projectors were stitched together by four. Those projection screens were four projectors actually filling that light.
They were they doubled up?
Yeah.
as
well?
Well,
I don't know. No. They were in four different locations. There might have been two lights at the location. I couldn't tell because they went really close.
Yeah.
No, they were in a row. Yeah.
Yeah. I just remember looking at the projection and thinking that looks better than a plasma LCD screen.
Right. It was
like
really
amazing.
You know,
it just really.
So that's what. So that's the other thing that the human race can do when it spends way too much
money.
Shows like that. I mean, the track system and the flying system is great. Being able to fly someone in horizontally and vertically controlling them is incredible, right?
Mm-hmm.
In
Absolutely.
Four directions at the same time. I remember at one point looking down at the staging and, you know, the action and what was happening. I'm not going to describe the show very much, but a whole bunch of activity going up. And I was like, this is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. Oh, and there's six people flying too. Like,
yeah.
I was, that's the thing. It's like, oh, and there's more.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah. And that's why Cirque.
So I suggest you don't go to Las Vegas, but if you do, go see a Cirque show.
That's my suggestion as well. Yeah.
You can see
Jerry Seinfeld, but I mean, the Cirque show.
I know. See,
I
haven't done live comedians and I should. That's awesome. That's a hard thing to do as comedians.
Absolutely. It is.
All right. Well, let's go with one of your first stories, sir.
Sure. Which is that most IT workers don't have STEM degrees. STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math, which I found in some ways very...
Wait, most which don't?
Most IT workers. So workers in IT, so dealing with computers, fixing computers, all that stuff. the basic statistics here are... that most of them don't have college degrees in computer science, technology, engineering, or math.
I don't.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. About a third come to IT with degrees in business or social sciences or any other non-technical fields.
Hmm.
I have a degree in theater arts, so that's not a technical field. Well, I did technical theater, but it's considered not a technical field, I think. And then 40% of computer support specialists and a third of computer system administrators don't have any kind of college degree at all. And they get into it other ways.
I wonder if that's just a period of time that defines those numbers. Because, you know, when I went to college, there was computer science, but there wasn't, like, I didn't think of IT as a profession.
Yeah.
You know? And definitely ten years older than me, you're definitely in a situation where you're not going to go to school for computer science, right? So it kind of makes sense that there was such a boom in growth and not a lot of people taking the field that you have going to have a moment in time where there's a lot of people that happen to be in that space because you know, if you go through your chemistry degree and you figure all that out, when you get out of college, you get to work in chemistry and that's what you're going to do.
Yeah.
But if you come out of work and you're trying to find work or you don't have a college degree and you're trying to find work in a field that's just exploding like IT,
yeah.
It seems like people would fall into that. So I think that's more just a consequence of where we are in the growth of IT.
Maybe. I mean,
information technology, is that really the best way for us to describe the computer field?
That's a good point. I mean, well, as a front end web developer in Silicon Valley, it's just amazing to me how different computer related fields are from anything else. Like especially other technical fields, like you were saying, like physics or science or other sorts of science, chemistry or something. Like you really have to go to college for this particular field in order to work in this field. You know, you can't say, all right, I graduated high school, I taught myself some chemistry, can I work at your biomed firm? You know, it just doesn't really work that way, but it definitely works that way with computers. So if you go sit around and teach yourself HTML and CSS and JavaScript and maybe a library like jQuery, you can build websites for big companies and be a contractor, and it's just really weird to me.
You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and the air with me is Ben Jaffe. And I've been totally stressed out, Ben, and I'm finally less so, and doing the show with you is definitely a relaxing thing and a lot of fun. So thanks for being here.
It's strange.
I've
going
been so
on the
stressed
radio
out.
With a bunch of people listening. That's
we, yeah.
a relaxing thing for you.
20,000 people and you. I'm good. So
why have you been stressed out?
I've just been doing a lot for work. You know, I traveled to Vegas, of course. That was also partial work. And then this last week, I did a giant conference, which I invited you at the last minute. And thank you for going. It was a lot of fun. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah.
But during all that time, one thing you don't do when you're going to be on stage, you're presenting, you're coding and getting things ready, is you do not modify your computer.
Ever.
So I haven't done anything about Mavericks. I haven't paid attention to Mavericks. And you said you actually upgraded.
What's Mavericks?
The Mavericks is the new OS X operating system.
Absolutely.
And... Mm-hmm. I didn't do it because it seems to always be a bit of pain. Normally, I do it quickly so that I can have that experience and then share the pain with everybody. So will you please share the pain of what Mavericks is like?
There was none, actually.
What?
So I was actually in your same situation just not too long ago. I updated 2.5 days ago, so take that with a grain of salt. I haven't really had any problems over these 2.5 days.
and all you've been doing was working in your garden. You upgraded, closed your computer, and went to your garden.
Yeah.
No problems at all.
Yeah.
No,
and then
so
my,
it's...
No, it seems really stable. Actually, I was in the middle of working on... working on recording an e-learning training video series, and so you don't upgrade your computer when you're in the middle of that because things break, and then you know you're yeah. kind of can't do it. So I finally finished that project, which I was mainly happy about because I got to update my computer to Mavericks. And my housemate, who works for Apple, basically said, "Do it. It is free. Free. Not you but, don't.
No,
pay.
This is not a dot
no,
improvement.
This is,
this
not,
is a full number. I mean, this is a full release improvement."
Yeah, I was previously running version 10.8. Now I'm running version 10.9. Normally, right.
That costs money. Normally, like $50 or something.
I mean, for a while, they cost $129. Then they cost I think $59 and then $39 or something like that. Now it's free. So
if your computer can support it, so it has to be a computer bought in the last 3 years or so.
No, I think it'll run on pretty much anything that ran. What was the last version? Mountain Lion.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But the last couple of years. I mean, old Macs won't have this. Free operating system upgrade, that's a difference on Apple's track. That's different.
It is different.
Why are they doing it?
Well, let's think about the mobile space for a second. Because really, ultimately, our laptops and our phones are pretty much the same thing. They're a different form factor, but they're the same kind of device. But there's this tremendous difference in the way we interact with our phones and what we expect from our phones versus our computers. Especially if you run Windows, you're expected to pay a lot of money for products like Microsoft Office or like your operating system itself, right? You could pay $300-$400 for installation of the newest version of Windows or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. But on your phone, I'm not going to pay 99 cents for an app. No way. Like, why is it that we're completely fine?
Well, no, I think 99 cents you do. I think a lot of people pay up to $6 for apps.
I would not pay $6 for an app. No.
Well, but
not
you're different.
I mean, come on.
Like, how little work can I do and love my life? I mean, that's a wonderful place to be, and that's not you're not going to buy Angry Birds, right?
Have to buy Angry. Oh yeah, that's right.
I don't buy games on my phone. What are you talking about?
I played Angry Birds until I had to pay, and then I decided not to.
Right, I knew that would be true for you. That's
and you know what? I'm happier now that I'm not playing Angry Birds.
Yes.
Really, like
your soil is happier.
I have so much time, but But anyway, so why is there this huge difference, right? There's this huge expectation difference. And for the operating system, like, I would never upgrade my Android operating system or iOS or whatever if I had to pay money mm-hmm. to get a new version of my
right.
operating system, especially because there's a disincentive built into it. Usually when you upgrade to a new operating system, you are perturbed in some way.
You have some pain.
Either right. you can't find something that you used to be able to find, you're not sure where it went, or something breaks.
Change is hard,
absolutely. So that's, I think, the model that Apple is moving towards. OS updates are free. That way, your computer is always running the best it can run.
Yeah.
And then they have the Apple, the Mac App Store as well. So they're buying applications through Apple.
So when I upgraded the last time, so I'm on 10.8, I can't remember the cat names and all that, but when I upgraded the last time, mm-hmm. And I always, by the way, if I'm on 10.8, any of the security stuff patches, the dot extensions after that, I always take.
Yeah, those are all free.
Yeah, and also it's important because those are security vulnerabilities that they're fixing. So if you leave those off, it's a problem. But when I went to like 10.8, the things that were mostly noticeable is different UI choices that I didn't actually like, mm-hmm. right? Those were the things I actually noticed about it. Is Mavericks like that? Does it have a completely different launcher or some strange thing like that?
Actually, no, there are not a lot of changes. Let me just describe a couple of the things that I've noticed about Mavericks.
We're talking about Macintosh OS 10.9, the newest version, which is free for all Macintosh.
Yeah, that's actually one of the reasons I'm so comfortable talking about it on the air is that I'm not saying, hey, go out and buy the latest version of whatever. I'm just saying update your device, you know?
We are talking about Apple, though.
We are talking about Apple,
but
yes. But I have an Apple. You have an Apple. Those are the computers that we most often use.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, though, the biggest feature of this new OS update was the battery life. So before, if I got down below 50%, I would start panicking, like, uh-oh, I need to find an outlet really soon. But my battery life went up by 40% or so.
Wow, that's impressive.
So, I mean, I've been unplugged starting at 100% since 9 o'clock. It's currently 10:32.
Now, that might not be the operating system itself. It might have just been the upgrading, what happened to your machine when it got upgraded, in the sense that it cleaned things up. It might have been a process that was running things up.
They actually have a number of features for energy saving. For example, if you have an application and it ends up entirely obscured by some window, let's say you have a Chrome window or a Safari window in front of it, it'll actually dial back the CPU usage of that application almost down to zero, so it doesn't use up as much battery. So that's one of the things. They call it app nap, but you know, there's actually another thing that I think is really interesting. If you click on the battery, it shows you how much time is remaining, what the percentage is, and it also says apps using significant energy, Google, Chrome, Canary. So it's almost energy shaming these applications. Like if these applications pop up a lot in that menu, it gives the developers of the applications to...
That's an Android feature, right? Like that's built into Android OS.
Is it?
Well, at least the one I'm running. Yeah, you can go take a look at power consumption, memory consumption.
It's not so accessible, though.
Oh, well, I'm using a Cyanogen mod, so mine's accessible, but that's just a modified version of
Cyanogen.
Okay.
That's great.
We're all over the place right now.
So anyway, there are all these different things that increase the battery usage. And I mean, just because it's free, I'm not saying go buy a Mac, but I'm saying if you have a Mac... and you can upgrade. It's through the software, just software update. Do it. I would highly recommend it. Of course, always back up your machine before you do anything like this. Always have a backup of your machine regardless, because you will lose data when your hard drive eventually does crash. So back it up now, and then you won't lose your data. But in my personal experience and the couple people I've talked to about Mavericks, they have had no upgrade woes whatsoever. I had one small compatibility thing with an AU plugin for Logic Pro or something like that, and so I just ran the installer again and it fixed itself. But I mean, my problems were basically zero, and a lot of positive improvements too.
Now, will you be here on Geek Speak next week?
I probably won't. Okay. I can open my calendar.
Let's assume that you are. So Ben is suggesting that if you're running Windows, go ahead and upgrade. I mean, sorry, Macintosh OS. Go ahead and upgrade to version 9. And then Ben will be on air next week answering calls, so he can help people with the process.
Oh, no. Make a backup, though. I said that.
Microsoft also released a version 8.1 of Windows, and it definitely has improvements as well. And that was a free version from 8. Now, it's a little different.
8.1, though. That's a dot release.
Yeah, but so... yes, absolutely. Okay, let's not go into it. You're right. It's a different type. It's a different stage.
Yeah, it's
true. Okay, the other thing that Apple's announced was that new sales of computers starting today, whenever they said this, will include their entire iWork suite, which is the competitor to Microsoft's Office.
Word.
Office, excuse me. Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. Apple has Pages, which is Word equivalent, Numbers, which is Excel equivalent, and Keynote, which is equivalent to Microsoft's. Any case, those will be free for users after when you buy a new machine at this point, and continually, which is interesting because the way that currently Microsoft makes money in the Macintosh world is by selling Office Suite to Macintosh users, because you can still buy Office for Macintosh.
Yeah.
And so that just kind of... Apple's, with that decision, is basically, you know, slicing the revenue source from Microsoft. Microsoft doesn't make a lot of revenue off of that, but it is that compatibility kind of issue where at least you have Microsoft playing on a Macintosh machine.
At the same time, there's been Google Docs for a very long time,
and
you can use everywhere. That anywhere for free.
And well, that's, I think, why they're doing it, right? They want them using their product rather than Google's product.
Oh, also, there's a new Maps application that comes with Mavericks. I don't think it's as good as what Google has done in the browser, but it's close.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think people are going to be using that Maps application a lot more because it's right there in their docs. It's actually added to their docs. So,
well, thank you for the upgrade of Mavericks. This weekend, I will go ahead and try to upgrade my machine in the background when I'm hanging out with my family.
I just had one more thing to add. They asked Linus Torvalds, the guy who, one of the main people who works
on started Linux.
He wrote started Linux.
That's why Linux has its name.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's Linus.
Someone asked him, like, so what about Apple and the free OS, and is that going to be impacting Linux? And basically, Torvalds said there's a big difference between the term open and the term free. And Linux is open. You can do whatever you want to Linux. You can see exactly why things work, kind of like the web. Pretty much any plugin that you might decide to use, you can see how it works.
Right.
OS X is not open, but it is free. So,
yes, it's a very big difference. Yeah. I deal with open source software and licenses that make it not free. So it gets really complicated to talk about that. Mm-hmm. But I highly believe, especially in our more security-aware world, that or privacy-aware world, that we need to focus more on the idea of open source. Because the truth is, when I take an operating system from Apple and I install it on my machine, for me to figure out what it's doing, I have to query and interact with the application, the operating system, if you think of it as an application, which it is. And it can lie to me. And so it becomes extremely difficult to know what's actually happening. Additionally, some security features that Apple built in, which I think are fantastic for protecting a user's machine access, mandate that the operating system have more power, if you will, and therefore Apple intrinsically has more power on your computer than you do. And mm-hmm. that's a little creepy. It's a trust that we're doing with this company, but the idea of trusting a company is kind of insane on the ethical perspective, because if you think about what a company actually is, if you try to personalize it and use ethics with it, it's very clear that corporations are psychopaths, sociopaths. So yeah. You can't really take that idea of trust. You have to then say, well, it's in their best interest to treat me this way, and therefore I can trust that they're treating me that way because yeah. it's their self-interest thing, which is different than people. I don't normally put it that way with people. I don't go, well, this person probably won't stab me in the gut because it would affect their lifestyle in a certain way. I don't think of it that way, like they'll go to jail. I think that this person probably doesn't want to harm me because they're a human being.
Yeah.
But with companies, you have to think in another way. You have to think about their motivations the entire
absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely, yeah. It's kind of sad.
I saw this really interesting story about this kind of mystery, hulking, giant, floating thing. So in the San Francisco Bay.
Yeah.
In the San Francisco Bay, this is a large structure. And this is my geek bit, by the way, for today, because I'll link to it so you can see the pictures too. This is a giant structure. And the headline is Google building a hulking floating data center in SF Bay? Now, I was on the bay yesterday, as were you. In fact, you transported me across the Bay Bridge. And I didn't see this thing. So it must not be that big. I believe it's below the Bay Bridge. But it clearly looks like a large floating data center. Totally makes sense. And there's assumption that Google's doing it. But the question I've got, I assume this is being done all the time anyway. And it makes sense that if these non-governmental entities like Google, which kind of starts expanding outside of its scope of being controlled by a government, it makes sense to have its giant resources outside in international waters because they have completely different management capabilities. Yeah. Anyway, I just thought that was kind of a cool story. You've got one, and I'm going to ask you to tell me, well, just hint it, because then we're going to go to
break. This is a geek bit or a story?
Yeah, sure.
Oh,
do the geek bit.
The geek bit, okay. Oh, by the way, I just want to say that I saw the picture of the thing you were just describing. For those of us who are Star Trek fans, it kind of looks like a Borg probe.
Yeah. It looks like a Borg rectangle instead of a cube.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which is a Borg probe.
Oh,
it's a
Borg
rectangle.
Probe. Oh,
yeah, I actually
right.
just, I spent
there's
the
also,
last
there's also
30 seconds
circular ones as well.
Yeah, the Borg sphere. Yeah, Borg Queen's ship. I've got two geek bits. You want both?
One.
I've got some awesome, awesome optical illusions for you guys. So after the show, go to
geekspeak.
Our website, geekspeak.org, and take a look at these optical illusions. They are really cool.
Ben, we hung out at a winery yesterday, and last night we were having wine, not beer. And you have some weird story about beer. And it's and it reminds me, and before we start with this,
yes,
do we ever get a conclusion about the battery bouncing thing?
The battery bouncing thing?
Yeah.
Battery bouncing. What
you
battery
came on and told
a
story. Wasn't it you? Or was it somebody else about bouncing a battery to determine how much charge it has?
Oh no, that was that Al.
Okay, we'll have to get that story back to you guys. I still have the answer.
Never mind.
All right. So this one sounds like that. Tell me what this beer thing is.
So I don't frequent pubs, so I've never actually experienced this. But apparently, right. if you're
well, because you're in the U.S., you're in California, and you're not 21.
So
yet,
I don't so. Really. I am totally. I'm God. You're ridiculous. So, but anyway, apparently a practical joke you can play on somebody when you're in the pub, it sounds like a really mean one to me, is if they're holding their beer can or their beer bottle, rather, you can take your beer bottle and hit the top of their beer bottle to jerk it. And not hard enough that they lose that they lose purchase on it and it falls to the ground. Not like that, but just enough that it perturbs the liquid inside enough to release a bunch of bubbles, and then it foams up and it foams over, and you can't, you know, and your hand gets all wet and all of that. Anyway, I've never actually heard of this until now, but apparently it's called beer tapping. And it is, according to the article, quote, the kind of jerky thing that jerks do at bars. But some scientists were thinking, well, gosh, we have a high-speed camera, and it'd be really cool to take some footage of this and try and figure out also why this works.
Oh, so they did it in high speed.
Yeah, so they did it in high speed, and they it's just really neat footage. It's really neat footage. They have a basic explanation of how it cool. works, and it turns out that it's actually preventable. If someone beer taps your beer bottle, there is a way of preventing it, but you have to react within 1 millisecond.
No, which is that's not humanly not possible.
It's not humanly possible, but apparently, like, from the time of the tap to the first implosion of a single bubble, about 1 millisecond passes. If you could cap it by taking your thumb and putting your thumb over the top of it, then and prevent CO2 from getting out, apparently that would actually stop the chain reaction before it starts. It would prevent the chain reaction.
Oh, interesting.
So anyway, if you want more information about that, you should check out this really cool slow motion video. And while you're at it, search YouTube for other slow motion videos and waste a couple days watching slow motion videos.
I don't understand. If you have a beer bottle and I have a beer bottle, they're basically the same state. And I take mine and tap it on the top of yours. Aren't both the bottles going to do this?
No.
Or you cause an air compression at the top of the main bottle, causing a compression. And then when it releases that compression, the air bubble forms and then it does a chain reaction. Ah, yeah, makes sense. Okay, I got it.
Right,
thanks.
Cool.
I love figuring out stories like that. Hey, if you want to ask us questions or make a comment about what we're doing on the radio, the phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Is it 655-KUSP? Yeah.
655-KUSP.
800-655-5877. We'll take any calls at all. Anything you want to ask us, we would be happy to address. We might say, that was a great question, and then say goodbye. But we'll probably ramble on with an answer that will probably help you or entertain us.
I want to go totally, totally off the script and ask you a question about the conference that you basically ran with your company.
Yeah. Should we do that, though?
Yeah, I want to talk about the conference because there were a lot of great speakers. There were a lot of interesting topics that were talked about. It's a JavaScript conference would you say you ran it or were you one of... Yeah, you ran it.
Well, so, okay.
But like,
this is really interesting, right? Because the whole idea of public radio is to be non-commercial, right?
Yeah.
That's why whenever you hear us talk about somebody that might support the station, we say factual information. We don't do any kind of... judgment calls on what they are. So if we talk about a company that gives money to the station, we say this company does this, and we, you know, sometimes we'll say we appreciate that they give us money and they're available to do these services at these times and these services are available to you. You know, but that's it. We can't say this is a great company or they are good at what they do because that becomes a commercial.
Or they're the best or they're
right.
So it's
very different. And then there's other regulations too. We're not supposed to talk about the price of something, right? So I was able to say that the new OS 10 thing is free and the old ones used to be $129 and $50. But if it currently costs $65 to get the new OS 10, if it did, I wouldn't want to say it costs $65 because
it
then I'm kind of
like
commercializing.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, so
there's a lot of...
It's like between $50 and $75. It's
right.
In that range-ish.
And that's why when you listen to public radio, there's a very clear understanding that we're not trying to sell you on something. Now, we can also offer our opinions. Like Ben just said that he likes OS 10, right? But that I get sensitive when you say that we both have Macintosh computers because... It kind of says that the KUSP endorses that. And that is not true at all. That's why at the beginning of the show, every week, I say the views expressed on GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP, right? To say it's our views, right? Okay, anyway.
Yeah, and KUSP has non-Macs in the station, too. That's what we edit the podcast on every week.
That's true. We use Windows machines, yeah. So when you say, you know, let's talk about your job, what you do, it's like, well, I don't want to be commercial for what I do. And this is like, am I
a
news person? Am I a commentary? I have a day job. So for years at UCSC, for example, I almost never had anybody on that I talked with on the show. And of course, these people are like making portable projectors you can hang in the hallway and interact through HDP and project interactive art pieces, right? That's totally geek speak content, but I tried not to like promote it because it was what I did for work. So you're asking me what the conference was like that I just spent a year planning or 6 months planning. So I did it with a staff, a big group of staff, and it was me and one other person that decided all and all the speakers. And I pulled in people that I thought were interesting in the JavaScript world. The one that I think is really appropriate for geek speak is code.org. And I've talked about code.org before. And Ali Pertovi spoke for us about code.org. In fact, we did an auction, silent auction at the end of the night. All the sponsors gave items, and all the money of that silent auction actually went to code.org. And code.org's mission is to bring computer science to middle schools, high schools at least, and I think all the way through the educational stack. But basically, it's this idea that it is crucial that people learn get a general understanding of how to program, a general understanding of computer science, and sort of move that into academic space. So code.org is a nonprofit designed to promote education in the U.S. about computer science before college. Mm. And I really believe in the mission. You know, I think that people should be more technically minded. That's why I do Geek Speak. And so it was nice to have Ali there and talking about it. And I didn't know, when I introduced him, we were chatting and we were being on stage, I didn't know much about him. So I normally do interviews in that way. And one of the things he said is that he started it with his brother. His twin brother and him started it, which I think is fascinating. And one of the things they did to kind of get the promotional cycle going is to commit that they would be committed to this thing for the rest of their lives. And so then he's like, after it was really successful, we've got to be. Which I kind of like the idea that I believe in this, so I'll make a public announcement that I believe in it and I'm going to do this. And then once you've done that, you've got to follow through, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of a new way to motivate yourself.
Are they a nonprofit?
They're a nonprofit.
Yeah.
And it's cool. They bought a domain name first, then they bought the software. Then after they did both of those things, then they started the organization.
That's so backwards.
And if you go to code.org, there's a great video there that kind of describes a bit of it. And I feel comfortable talking about code.org, of course, because it's a nonprofit.
Yeah.
Also, I feel comfortable supporting the conference I just did because a lot of the people that are speaking there are open software people. They develop open software. Then they go to a conference, talk about it. They make their money by being hired by some other company to do products. But then on their sideline, or even for that company, they're producing the software, they're making it open and available to everybody, and with like a license that makes it, you can do anything you want with it, which is kind of cool. So it has, that show has the feeling of Geek Speak in that sense.
Yeah. One of the talks that I loved was on Firefox OS.
And, very cool.
Again, I feel fairly comfortable talking about that because Firefox, or Mozilla rather, the people who put it out, is a nonprofit.
Okay, so that's an interesting case because I've learned a lot more about them as I'm part of the W3C and I sit on a web apps committee and we talk about web application development improvements, what the browsers are going to do next. Mozilla's always there, right? And so is Chrome and so is Opera and so is Microsoft and all of these people represent their own interests quite a bit. And when I was talking with kind of the organizers about, well, I really like Mozilla stuff because they're a nonprofit, he said, well, the parent company's nonprofit. But the truth is the way Mozilla works is there's a nonprofit institution, an organization, the foundation, that has a nonprofit mission, has an important mission. But then they own a corporation that makes money. And so that corporation can make money. KOSP could do this, for example. We could commercialize GeekSpeak for something, make it a corporation, and then KOSP could own that entity, for example. Though I think I might want to own that entity. Who knows? Anyway, that's Nick Dezonlilis. I think that's how you pronounce his name. Did the Firefox talk. And basically, it's a new operating system for phones. It's not Android. It's not Apple. It's not RIM. It's a new one. And they're launching it outside the U.S. to get good market share in other countries so they can be a player. Because in this market share, it's really hard to be in the U.S. with a new operating system.
Yeah.
But the operating system is like web friendly. So for you and I, we're like, ooh, that's so cool.
Because any hacking we do, hacking in the positive term, any hacking we do is usually with web technologies. So
if you're curious about what I do in my day job and all that, if you go to my Twitter feed, I'm Lyle, L-Y-L-E on Twitter, you'll see like things like that, like videos of that venue and things of that like, because my day job is actually being a public figure as well as my volunteer for KOSP and doing Geek Speak is a public figure. So I just kind of post a lot of stuff, probably too much. You said we had a call. Do you want to introduce them?
We do. We have Kirkland from Santa Cruz. And what's your question?
Welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Hey, I've got a MacBook Pro, a 4.1 model, and I'm serious hardware problem. The thing won't boot. And I want to get my data off it, But the thing is for migration system, you need to enable it in that target computer. So any ideas?
Okay, so do you have a Firefox? I mean, do you have a... No.
Wait, actually, no. The first question is, what do you mean by it won't boot? Does that mean that you press the power button and nothing happens, or do you get a white screen, or what?
No, I get the gray screen with the progress bar at the bottom.
Uh-huh. And does anything happen with that?
No.
Okay.
No.
Do you have...
When I open it up in target mode, I still can't do anything with that either. It's not recognized.
So you can't get into target disk mode?
It can get in target disk mode. The problem is that when I try to hook my other laptop up to it, it doesn't recognize it. It doesn't appear.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So
okay, Ben, what's target disk mode?
Target disk mode. Yeah. So basically, with especially older Macs that have FireWire ports, or the higher end models that have FireWire ports, you can hold down. I think it's either T or Command T.
Just T.
When you boot,
and it will it'll go into this mode called target disk mode. Basically, it'll mount your computer as if it were an external hard drive. That way, you can copy stuff off of that computer onto another computer. So that's good if your operating system.
Turns your expensive laptop into an external hard drive.
Yeah.
For something else, but you're not having that problem. I would assume that your hard drive actually is the problem. Only because that target disk mode is a very low level thing. You actually just reinitiate the FireWire system to then be in the opposite flow. Which FireWire can actually change, so it's not a big deal. But the point is that's not even a hard drive level thing.
Yeah.
So because you can go into that mode and then the hard drive is not actually readable, it probably is a hard drive thing. Now, getting your data doesn't mean you can't get your data off, but you'll probably have to pull that hard drive from your computer to then do anything else. That version, is your hard drive behind the battery? No, it's not. Okay, so you basically have to do some really microsurgery kind of stuff to get that case open, and you have to do the thing that Ben loves. What's that plastic spatula called?
Spudger.
Spudger, yes.
Yeah,
and I have it.
Okay.
Wonderful.
Because on the same machine, I replaced the whole screen when it went out.
Oh, wow. You've done some serious tinkering. That's hard to do.
So you're not going to have a problem.
All right. So pull that drive out. And here's the thing. Okay. Here's another one where, should I commercialize this or not? If you want to fix a hard drive that's in a bad state, the product, it costs, I don't know. I can't really talk about the price, but it's enough where it's going to hurt. It's a product.
Oh, I know. It's like a couple $100.
It's less, the one I'm thinking is less than that. It's a product called Spinrite, which I've used many times. I love. It's made by Steve Gibson. Steve Gibson produces a lot of free content. A lot of stuff. When I talk about security, I've learned it from Steve Gibson. He's got a great podcast he gives away. And the one product he actually sells is called Spinrite, and it's a hard drive maintenance tool. And it costs some money, and you have to run it on a Windows-type machine, an Intel-based machine. It's a DOS-level app right now. He is releasing an OS X version, but I don't know if it's out yet. That's the best case chance for you to get your data back off that drive and give that a shot. Or find someone that has that app for you and have them run it for you. They can do that as a favor, too, in the license agreement.
Well, to that, I had... a virtual PC on that machine. If I had it on my new machine, then I could probably go in that and use the same app.
Yeah, well, the app you have to run, you cannot run inside Windows. You have to boot the machine off of a disk, you know, from USB, you might be able to use Apple now, but you basically have to use non-Apple product to do that. But basically, it'll work on any operating system once the drive is then run. This application is running. It's going to go through every sector and inspect it and try to move parts for you and kind of help the hard drive fix itself.
You might be able to run it on VirtualBox, which is
that process is really complicated. But you can. But you're
yeah,
not
but
on
I found a tutorial. So I mean, if you Google around, you'll be able to find more information on what will work and what won't.
And his newest version does support OS X. I just don't think it's out of beta yet. All right. Well, thank you. That's Spinrite to fix your hard drive, or you take it to some place and it's going to be expensive.
Okay, I made those notes. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you so much for the call.
Yeah, I'll need it.
You know, every time I open a Mac with that tool, I can never get it back the same way.
You don't need it anymore, though.
No,
not
you
with
don't.
The new ones.
Not with
the new ones, the bottom.
You know what, though? I don't open the new ones anymore.
I just like saying the word spudger. That's really all it comes down to.
You know, I just like that you say it because I add an L in there and that gets all complicated. I think we're closing up the show. We've got a few more minutes left. Why don't you tell one more story if you've got one?
Tell one more story.
Sure.
Story
well, I'll tell
time.
One.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wait. We should Rochambeau.
Rochambeau.
Okay, I got paper.
You
so,
two out of three? No,
Bitcoin, this digital currency it's a currency based off the rules of physics and a bit of initial state and
physics, cryptography.
Well, and just that, yeah. Normally we do currency based off the trust of a government. This one is off the trust of math. I like it better in that sense.
Yeah,
and you have to make an agreement still that this is the one we're going to use. But other than that, it's mathematically more stable. I won't get into it. There's other shows about Bitcoin. But there'll be a Bitcoin ATM in Canada. You'll be able to go in, put U.S. dollar cash in, pull out digital currency. This is cool. It's changing the world. Blah, blah, blah. This has been another almost hour of Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. Ben, thank you for joining me today.
Absolutely. It was fun.
Rick Philman has been answering phones. We'll be back next week to talk about technology. If you'd like to ask us questions during the week, you can email us. Also, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus and all those things. And all the tough stuff we talk about in the next half an hour, Ben and I will get on the website. And of course, the podcast will be up as well. See you next week, and thanks for listening to Geek Speak. Bye, Ben.
Bye-bye.